When you start seeing the tic-tac thing, it looks a bit different from what they were seeing in the 1950s, but it's essentially the same kind of thing. It's just kind of smooth, has high performance, high speed, runs circles around our jets. That's the same thing that we were getting back then.
News, science, the unexplained, space and the cosmos, exploring our past, our future, and the mysteries of our universe. Taking a critical look at reality and a journey to the edges of human understanding. The future is now. This is Micah Hanks.
From the high mountains of Appalachia in a bunker below ground, welcome one and all to the Micah Hanks program. Glad as always to be here with you and be your host as we go careening off through space and time in pursuit of the enigmatic, as we do every week from 7 to 9 p.m. East Coast time worldwide around the globe via KGRARadio.com and listen on demand via podcast apps everywhere. I haven't gotten one of those really flashy deals with Spotify yet, like one big podcaster has gotten, but we are on that medium. We are on, of course, all mediums and happy to be bringing you news, views, and perspectives on the anomalous. And this week, of course, in addition to some big space news, let me tell you, this was a tremendous week for SpaceX and Elon Musk. Finally, we had liftoff on Saturday. We'll be touching on that a little later. And also a legendary gentleman who will be joining us, the famed folklorist Thomas Bullard. Someone widely known in the Fortean community and a commentator on, as the title of his book will tell you, the myth and mystery of UFOs. And I want to say right here at the outset, it's really been a year of bucket list conversations for me. Dr. Jeffrey Meldrum. Over the weekend, the Seven Ages guys and I, we dropped another interview where we got to speak with Dr. Tom Dillahay, the archaeologist, one of the most influential archaeologists of all time, mind you, but who also led excavations beginning back in the 1970s down at Monte Verde in Chile. And to talk with him was just really a game changer. And there have been a lot of those this year, but Dr. Tom Bullard, who will join us in hour two, he's another one of those, who I think is probably regarded as one of the most serious academics to have looked at the UFO issue in the last several decades. But his book, The Myth and Mystery of UFOs, is not one that explains away UFO sightings as mere mythology. It's a very interesting approach he has because as a professional folklorist, Thomas Bullard, or Eddie, as he likes to be called, absolutely looks at the reality, some tangible phenomena behind UFOs, but he understands also that in the absence of a clear understanding of what exactly this phenomena may represent, we also have to look at the human side of this. And most researchers are either or. You know, they're either nuts and bolts guys, or they are people who say, maybe there's nothing more than a myth here. And so Dr. Bullard kind of gives us this perspective in what my pal Dr. Thomas Glass would call, boy, a lot of Dr. Thomases in this community, huh? But he often talks about that moo perspective. He and Tim McMillan and I were having a great conversation on Zoom a while back, and he had said, you know, I advocate that moo perspective. This is a reference to Zen and the Art of Motorcycle Maintenance. And again, he has convinced me that this is a book probably that every Fortean should read because it helps give us a framework on how to approach topics that we don't have a full understanding of. You know, there's always that back and forth between the believers and the skeptics. Sometimes there is a middle path, a middle way, a middle theory, if you will. And boy, it's one of those weeks that I don't necessarily dread, but I recognize as being a little harder than usual as it relates to my other podcast of that name, which, by the way, people over the weekend, with all of the turmoil that we have been seeing in the last few days following this tragedy that occurred up there in Minneapolis and the death of George Floyd. We will save that discussion for the Middle Theory podcast, but a lot of you guys out there were tweeting at me and saying, you know, we really need a balanced perspective right now with everything that's happening in the world, everything in terms of politics, everything in terms of the coronavirus pandemic, everything in terms of the rioting that is happening, not just in the United States, but around the world in response to what happened up there in Minneapolis. And I'll certainly be covering that on the Middle Theory podcast. In fact, actually, alumni of this program that he is, investigative reporter Tim McMillan, writer for Popular Mechanics and Vice. This week, I decided to tap him for a conversation on middle theory because having a background in law enforcement and having been a former instructor on issues like implicit bias with law enforcement and also still recognized as an expert associated with the Law Enforcement Action Partnership, I thought it would be really good to get him to come on that podcast and talk with me. So for those who are interested, many of you have been asking me on social media. We will have a very thorough conversation on that podcast this week. Although on this one, as I often do in times of turmoil, you know, our hearts do go out to those who have been affected, lives that have been lost, families that are shattered as a result of deaths that shouldn't have ever occurred. I am with you, and we mourn together in times like these, but I also think it is really important that we remember that we do have a voice and that we can affect change in our communities, but we should do so responsibly. And resorting to violence when we are confronted with the reality of violence in our world should never be our first response. All weekend, we were seeing the videos of riots, protests, looting, and the like on television, but you see far less coverage of the protesters in Minneapolis who were very peacefully demonstrating, who were bonding with law enforcement officers. Some of those peaceful protesters were in handcuffs, but they were standing there and talking with the arresting officers. There was no conflict. There was no violence. Far less often do you see on television the officers who were there on the scene responding to the crowds decked out in riot gear and who kneeled down in a display of respect and solidarity with those who were there protesting. I think it is important to remember that peace is always the right answer. And unfortunately, television doesn't show us as much of it as has been happening behind the scenes and actually right out there in the streets while the chaos is unfolded. There is good in this world, but we have to be the vehicles for that good. We have to be the vehicles for that peace. When we see tragedy, when we see senseless death, when we see chaos, when we see violence, when we see anger, when we see looting, when we see hatred for our brothers and our sisters out there in the world, giving the world more of that is not the right way to affect change. So let's be that change. Let's be the vehicles for peace. Strength, but strength through peace, not through more violence, my friends. I have to tell you, last night, right here in Asheville, North Carolina, I have never seen anything quite like this, but there was a group of protesters who marched through downtown Asheville. I wasn't there. I saw the video. This was posted online, and Matt Oakley, our Graylian Reverend, was kind enough to send this along to me. But there's this group of protesters that marches through town and down I-40 and onto the Smoky Park Bridge, which, if you've ever been to my town, it is, I guess, the largest bridge in the city limits that carries Interstate 40 over the French Broad River and over the beautiful River Arts District where some of our fantastic breweries are. And in this video, the protesters are stopped on the Smoky Park Bridge by a police blockade. There is tear gas being used. Never in my days did I think that I would ever see something like that occurring in my little old mountain town here in western North Carolina. These are indeed strange times, just not the kind of strange I'm talking about every week when I tell everybody stay strange. This is not that kind of strange. This is the kind of strange you don't want. And hence, I don't want to spend all day talking about it, but it is important when there are big things happening in the world that we do at very least take care of that. We touch on it and we remind one another that we're all human beings and that we have a part that we play. And there's a right and a wrong way to do it. But when things are getting scary out there and we need change, let's just remember that violence is the problem. It's not the answer. And if we want change, we need to be the kind of change we want to see in the world. Kind of like Gandhi said. And in addition to being the change, I think it's also important to be aware of the problems in the world, but not to become bogged down by them, not to become obsessed with them. You know, people often write to me and they say, I just don't want to look at the news these days. And I don't think avoiding the problems in the world is necessarily the best answer. We should be aware of things that are happening in our world, but I think that we should also pay attention to the achievements, the incredible things that technology affords us. You know, there's that old expression, the sky is the limit. And I think for a lot of us over the weekend, we were reminded that even that is no longer true. The sky is no longer the limit it once was. And with technology, we are moving into a new era of human spaceflight and exploration.
Stage one tanks pressing for flight.
T-minus 15 seconds. 10, 9, 8, 7, 6, 5, 4, 3, 2, 1, 0. Ignition. Liftoff of the Falcon 9 and Crew Dragon. Go NASA. Go SpaceX. Godspeed, Bob and Doug.
America has launched. And so rises a new era of American spaceflight, and with it the ambitions of a new generation continuing the dream.
Continuing the dream, indeed. This is one of the most exciting things. Is there really anything more exciting than that countdown? You know, you get your 30-second warning, you get your 15-second, but when that 10, 9, 8, I mean, New Year's Eve, when the ball's about to drop, that's fun. But when you're about to see a rocket blast against the Earth, propel itself against the gravitational pull that our planet exerts, and launch two human beings into space orbit where they successfully docked with the International Space Station. There are all these problems going on in the world. No, of course we shouldn't turn a blind eye to that, but let's not forget that we just sent two men into space. And this is the first time that an organization outside of a government space agency has managed to do so. I raise my glass, in fact, my can of probiotic root beer that I have right here on my desk. I raise it to you, Elon Musk, to you guys at SpaceX, to you folks at NASA who helped with this. This was a momentous achievement. And sometimes, ladies and gents, it's okay to stop and smell the flowers. This is going to be one of those moments I think many of us will remember for all of our lives. And special thanks to Lauren for sending that audio for us. We head over to space.com right now, who, of course, commented on the remarkable liftoff over the weekend. A shiny white Falcon 9 rocket lifted off from historic Pad 39A at NASA's Kennedy Space Center here at 3:22 p.m. Eastern Time, carrying SpaceX's Crew Dragon capsule into orbit. The launch kicked off SpaceX's landmark Demo 2 mission, which is sending NASA astronauts Bob Behnken and Doug Hurley to the International Space Station. Demo 2 marks the return of orbital human space flight to U.S. soil after a nearly decade-long absence, and it signals the beginning of a new era in space exploration, one led by commercial companies. And that really is incredible. It's one thing when you have government funding that results in the construction of rockets capable of carrying human beings off planet. But it is another thing entirely when you've got a company out there in California that's doing the same thing. But for those of you who are at home watching the launch on Saturday, and I was participating in an online event hosted by our friends over at Rogue Planet and watching back and forth between two separate monitors, but almost as impressive as the rocket launch itself is the Falcon 9 booster's first stage making its landing on SpaceX's drone ship, which had the best name ever, Of Course I Still Love You. But that booster being recaptured, again, recyclable space technology, I can't tell you how exciting that was. So kudos, Elon Musk. This is an exciting time, and I think in a lot of ways, we really needed this right now. America and the rest of the world needed to be reminded that we can do incredible things when we pool our resources and remember that, no, the sky is no longer the limit, only our imagination. Now, I want to head over to the audio soundbites because shortly after the launch, representatives of SpaceX and NASA were on hand, including Elon Musk and, as we're about to hear from now, NASA Administrator Jim Bridenstine, as they were commenting on this historic series of events.
What a great day for NASA. What a great day for SpaceX. What a great day for the United States of America. It's been 9 years since we've launched American astronauts on American rockets from American soil. And now we have done it again. I want to be clear. The mission is not yet over. This is a test flight. And so we are at the beginning. But so far, everything has performed very, very well. And we are excited about the fact that Bob and Doug, our American heroes, are safely in orbit and on the way to the International Space Station. So I just want to say congratulations to the NASA team. Congratulations to Kathy Leaders, who's been on the NASA side leading our commercial crew program all along. And you and your team have done an absolutely marvelous job. And of course, Elon Musk and your team at SpaceX. This launch represents the best of everything that America has to offer.
It certainly was a showcase for the current state of American innovation. And of course, Elon Musk of SpaceX was also there on hand commenting on the current success of the mission.
Oh, I'd like to just acknowledge the incredible work of the people at SpaceX and NASA and everyone in creating this technology and what has culminated in this incredible launch today of getting astronauts back to orbit after almost a decade. I think this is something that should really get people, right on the heart of anyone who has any spirit of exploration. And the United States is a distillation of the human spirit of exploration. I think this is something that's particularly important in the United States, but appeals to everyone throughout the world who has within them the spirit of exploration. So, I'm really quite overcome with emotion on this day. It's kind of hard to talk, frankly. It's been 18 years working towards this goal, so it's hard to believe that it's happened. And we haven't quite yet docked the space station, and of course we need to bring them back safely, and we need to repeat these missions and have this be a regular occurrence. So it's a lot of work to do, it's just incredible. I think this is something that everyone, this is a craft made by humans, for humans. This is like something that I think humanity should be excited about and proud of occurring on this day.
It is almost surreal to see how excited Elon Musk is. And acknowledging, I'm having a little trouble even talking about this. Can you imagine 18 years in the making, a decade specifically working toward this? And then they had to postpone the initial launch. And finally, Saturday, we're down to that last 30 seconds, 15 seconds, 10, 9, 8. Before you see that rocket carry two men into space. Of course, I'm excited too. And it's not like we haven't done it before, but it's been a while since we have. And this is the first time that an independent company like SpaceX has achieved something like this. And I'm telling you, this is going to be a marker on the pathway to the future. Ladies and gents, now is a time for excitement and a time to rejoice the fact that when humans endeavor to get together and do incredible things, we can do that, even in troubling times like these. All right, we will be back right after this with more news and a few listener emails here on the Micah Hanks Program. Back it is, the Micah Hanks Program. Glad, as always, to be looking at the news, the developments, and of course, the enigmas that surround us in our world. A few of you guys have been sending in your own accounts of the odd which we will be getting into in just a bit. Although first, I do want to look at a little bit more in the way of news. There was a mysterious space object that we reported on a few weeks back. And initially, scientists had thought that this was something not only rare, but as yet unobserved. And what they were thinking at the time was that this object was, in fact, an asteroid, but one that had peculiar characteristics that made it look a lot more like a comet. And namely, the reason being that this asteroid appeared to have a tail. Well, now it has been announced that apparently that early assessment was incorrect. This object was, in fact, a comet after all. Although, as Science Alert reports, that doesn't really make it any less odd. And if you're like me, you might be wondering, well, if it seemed to be a comet in the first place, what about it made you think it was an asteroid? Asteroids don't have tails, comets do, so why did you think it was an asteroid? Well, as is often the case in the sciences, sometimes there are very minor differences between different classifications that we use. And if you really want to get all postmodern, some philosophers might even say that, well, really the classifications are just labels that we put on things arbitrarily, and no such differences in the grand scheme of things even exist. Now, I wouldn't really prescribe to that philosophy, but I do think at times that we are challenged sometimes by the standards of our own classification, especially when we observe things in the sciences or in nature that don't necessarily fit those parameters. In fact, I think that a lot of the so-called anomalous is simply something which defies scientific classification or categorization, and therefore people all too often are willing to say that it therefore does not exist. And in this instance, of course, astronomers see something that quite obviously is real, it's there, but it doesn't fit all of the criteria for either an asteroid or a comet, or at least it didn't at first. And as Science Alert reports, every now and again we do come across something that challenges these definitions. And the recently discovered asteroid, which was named 2019 LD2, was one of those cases. It had an asteroid-like orbit, but a comet-like tail. That's rare, but actually, it is not completely unknown. They say we call asteroids that exhibit comet-like characteristics active asteroids, and generally for them to fall into this little-known but not unheard-of category involves them producing outgassing or sublimation. But in the case of this peculiar asteroid-like comet, really what led to a lot of the confusion was where it was found, not so much its characteristics. Because the object apparently shared its orbit with Jupiter in an asteroid swarm known as the Jupiter Trojans, and it was thought to be the first Jupiter Trojan astronomers had ever seen spewing out gas like a comet would. However, a follow-up examination, Science Alert reports, initially prompted by amateur astronomers, has led to the realization that this isn't a brand new type of asteroid. It is, in fact, a regular comet that has a chaotically changing orbit which just so happens to currently resemble that of one of the Trojan asteroids. And hence all the confusion. But back to my earlier point, when you observe something in nature that at least doesn't easily fit known categories, and you are faced with what appears to be an anomaly, it's interesting to watch the process that one goes through. Well, maybe it's this. Well, maybe it's that. And in an instance like this, when we are actually able to eventually resolve the problem, well, now we know it's actually a comet. But it's a peculiar comet. It behaves in some ways like an asteroid, and so we can settle that debate. But there are those instances in nature where we observe things that are not so easily reconcilable. And although this aspect of the discussion could go in a lot of different directions as far as anomalies are concerned, I want to head over to the works of William R. Corliss, a longtime favorite of mine, and one of his reference works on solar system objects and strange phenomena related to astronomy. And just to give you an idea of some of the anomalous things that we associate with comets that you very seldom hear about, that he includes entries on in this book, are the following. Blinking comets. Ever heard of one of those? And in fact, the example they give here is a very well-known comet, which makes it even stranger. As he mentions, so far this phenomena does not seem to have been observed prior to the 1986 apparition of Halley's Comet. Since two scientific groups detected the same brightness pulsations with their instruments, we can have high confidence in the reality of this phenomenon, at least for Halley's Comet. As for other comets, they are almost never acquired and studied before the formation of their comas. We cannot therefore state that this is or is not a general property of comets. Now, keeping in mind this was written a few years ago, it's probably been observed again in recent years. But getting to the example that he gives from 1984 and 1985 when Halley's Comet appeared, he notes two groups of astronomers detected a night-to-night variation in the brightness of Halley's Comet while it was still at great distances from the Sun. Now that's important because, of course, when a comet is drawing close to the Sun, the actual heat that the Sun produces can cause various phenomena with comets. Of course, there's a lot of ice associated with comets and especially their tail, and so as some of that ice begins to melt, there can be little deviations in the behavior of the comet and things along those lines. But they were noticing these brightness changes while the comet was still a good ways out. R. M. West and H. Peterson, both of the European Southern Observatory, found one magnitude variations. Another group, associated with the Canada-France-Hawaii telescope, measured brightness changes of 1.7 magnitude amplitude. Variations were also observed during each night as well, from night to night. Which is kind of interesting because I bet most people aren't even aware that there was an anomaly like that associated with Halley's Comet, which is actually one of the best-known comets. But if you think that's even mildly weird, wait until you hear about the anomalous disappearance of comets. For example, Biela's Comet, perhaps the most famous of all comet mysteries. In 1846, it split into two parts, and then the two parts traveled side by side for some months. Returning in 1852, the two parts were separated by about 1,500,000 miles, but neither of them has ever been seen since, although astronomers estimate that they must have returned to the region of the Sun and the Earth at least 10 times. Never seen again. In 1872 and 1885, when Biela's return was expected, terrestrial sky watchers saw instead spectacular meteor showers, which might be a clue as to what had happened there. Another example that Corliss gives us, Comet Holmes. Holmes' comet of 1892 was large and bright when discovered in November of that year, but by December it had doubled its size and become almost transparent. Then in January it suddenly contracted again and showed a large nucleus. This is actually a case, he notes, of near disappearance and reappearance. The ephemeral nature of the nucleus of Holmes' comet is most curious. Although, again, we might suppose, and this is just me speculating, because I'm no astronomer, nor am I an expert on these sorts of things, but if I had to guess as to what kind of processes might have caused something like that, again, if we recall that comets, as they approach the Sun, begin to warm up and this causes ice to melt, it could be that some of the changes that were observed were related to the heating of the comet as it passed near the Sun. And of course, as one would expect, if that comet has approached the Sun and melted as it is leaving the vicinity of the Sun, some of the water may actually refreeze and return to a solid state, which would then again change the appearance of the comet as it is observed in its journey. Again, all speculation by an amateur, mind you, but I just want to point out that there are some known mechanisms that could account for some of the things that were seen. But now, how would we account for things like that in instances where there doesn't appear to be ice in association with a comet? Now, some might ask, well, how would you know whether or not there's ice? But there are instances where cometary reflection spectra, in other words, spectrographic observation of comets that help us determine what kinds of elements constitute the matter that we observe in a comet, some of them actually indicate no ice. And as Corliss notes here, occasionally the ices of H2O, CO2, NH3, and CH4 don't appear in reflection spectra from comets. And he writes, the infrared colors of comets are in fact similar to those of some asteroids, some satellites, and Jupiter's rings. When he mentions satellites, I presume we're talking about, you know, objects like the moon, natural satellites. But in one of the examples that he gives, he notes how the researchers Tuttle, Meyer, Stefano Terma, and Bowell note that, quote, our results do not rule out the presence of ices in the coma, and that use of the term, of course, related to comets here, not the other kind of coma. But they say, our results do seem to constrain the form of that ice to that of small, dirty particles. But anyway, I think you guys get the drift. There are a lot of odd things that have been observed about comets over the years. And in light of some of that, really the idea of a comet behaving or appearing similar to an asteroid might be the least of those. It's a weird, weird universe, my friends. Here's something else that's weird, but this a little more on the home front. Scientists, according to CNN, have created a mouse embryo that is part human, effectively a chimera, although it's only 4% human. The hybrid is what scientists call a human-animal, well, chimera, as I said, a single organism that's made up of two different sets of cells, in this case a mouse embryo that has both mouse cells and human cells. But again, that's the important point to make. This is not an actual mouse-human hybrid. This is merely a mouse embryo that is essentially 4% human. Now, they say that that is, nonetheless, by far the highest number of human cells ever recorded in an animal, according to researchers. Their experiment suggests that many types of human cells can be generated in mouse embryos and at a much faster rate than in human embryos, and that the scientists say carries enormous potential for the treatment of human diseases, possibly even COVID-19. Some of you guys may have seen over the years, though, some of the instances where lab-grown human parts were actually grown on mice and strange things like that. So here again, this isn't necessarily anything new, although some of the implications in the era of COVID-19 are certainly meaningful. CNN reports these findings are important for a number of reasons, according to Jian Feng, one of the study's authors and a professor of physiology and biophysics at the University of Buffalo, where the study was taking place. For one, it shows that it's possible to generate many types of mature human cells in mouse embryos, which could potentially be used to make cells, tissues, or organs, or again, to treat diseases. In this study, of course, stem cells were the ones that were used, 10 to 12 of them injected into developing mouse embryos. Within 17 days, those stem cells developed into millions of mature cells, including human red blood cells and eye cells. Now, I've just got to interject here. At the beginning of the show, I had mentioned, you know, we are all in this together, especially in times of trouble like those that we presently face on a global scale. We're all humans, but studies like this, however strange they may be, of course will be meaningful in terms of saving lives in the future. But another takeaway is, of course, if human cells can be injected into a mouse's embryo and thereafter begin to grow and multiply, again, I guess it just shows, biologically speaking, that we're all a lot more similar than we probably realize. I mean, we not just as team civilization here on Earth, but team life on Earth. We are all in this together, my friends. A few listener emails from you guys when we come back, and then we'll get to our conversation with Thomas E. Bullard, PhD, on the Micah Hanks program. Welcome back. It is the Micah Hanks program. Always when time allows, I like to get to letters that you guys have sent in. I've been getting a lot of them lately, and I apologize. Some of you I haven't gotten back to yet. Every now and then, folks who write in prefer not to have their messages read on the air. And of course, if you'd like to send a personal message to me, always indicate in your email if you would not like it to be read on the air. Otherwise, I will presume, especially if there's a story included, that you will want that shared on the program, if and when time allows. I've got time for a couple of them here. And the first one comes from Skip, who writes, "Hello, Micah. I recently discovered your podcast and have become an instant fan. I knew you and your brother are both musicians, but I didn't know until recently that you are into the UFO topic. That's always interesting when someone knows of me as a musician before they know of me as a podcaster or a UFO researcher." Skip says, "I really enjoyed the episode on black triangles. I saw a triangular-shaped craft in November of 1988. I've already typed up my experience and sent it to Earl Gray last year, and I recently contacted Ryan Sprague and shared my experience with him. And at this point, he features some of the message that he had sent to Earl." That's a great name, by the way. Earl Gray? My favorite tea, probably. "But he features some of that message to Earl, which reads as follows. I saw a black triangle in November 1988. This was way before I had even heard about triangle UFOs. I've never been able to find any reports about sightings of this kind in the South. When I told family and friends about it in 88, of course they thought it was nuts, but now triangle UFOs are commonly reported. I was told by a professor at Delta State University that it was probably a triangular-shaped weather balloon. I guess that could be possible. I don't know. I'm not saying that there couldn't have been a triangular-shaped weather balloon, but then again, that being that perennial explanation for UFOs from over the years, especially when I'm hearing about a triangle-shaped object, I generally tend to think it's at least possible it might have been an aircraft of some kind, but anyway, as Skip says, I don't remember it floating away or flying away, it was just gone and there was no noise. Here's the main narrative. He said, I was traveling north on Highway 1 between Fitler, Mississippi and Glen Allen, Mississippi, around the Grace community, and I noticed on the side of the road two older women standing next to an old Chevy C10 Apache pickup, and they were looking up into the sky, and one of them was pointing up. I pulled over on the side of the road near where they were parked and looked out the window on the passenger side and saw a black triangle way up in the sky just sitting there. I got out of my car and asked, what is that? How long have y'all been looking at it? One of the women replied, we don't know what it is, but we've been sitting here for about 5 or 10 minutes. And this is where it gets a little weird, or my memory is failing, one of the two. He says, I looked over and the women were getting back into their truck and they cranked the truck and left and I looked up in the sky and I didn't see it anymore. I got back in my car just puzzled, and that's why I say it didn't make any noise and I didn't see it fly away or float away. So simply it was just sitting there in the sky perfectly still, and the next thing I know, the event was over and it was gone, and the other and the two women were getting in their vehicle to leave. That's how I remember it. Unfortunately, all I have is the story, no proof of any kind. There is my experience. Thanks for having such an awesome podcast and point of view. P.S. I'm a musician and well-known harmonica player. We should get together sometime and jam. Sincerely, Skip. So, well, Skip, if I'm ever down that way and I have a guitar, we'll definitely have to make that happen. Jacob also writes in and says, Hi, Micah. My name's Jake. I'm 22 years old, and my dad and I are very longtime fans of your podcast. We're currently on our way to Jacksonville, Florida, and listening to your program. In this particular podcast, you were talking about a sixth sense that some people claim to possess. You mentioned that it is possibly just a not well-known natural phenomenon, and I agree 100%. I've actually got a first-hand account of this sixth sense. I used to have dreams as a kid that would come true weeks, months, and in one case, years later. Most often, they'd be little fragments of moments that barely made sense when I woke up. Things like hearing portions of sentences or seeing someone do something insignificant like dropping their phone or something. And I'd always forget these things within minutes of waking up. Then weeks or months later, these things would suddenly happen in the waking world and I'd have moments of intense déjà vu where I vividly remember the fraction of the moment that I dreamed about. Now, he says, the clearest example I have is from a time when I was 6 or 7 years old and I saw the apartment my family would move into a couple of years later. This particular dream was so vivid that I never actually forgot it. I excitedly ran up 3 flights of wooden stairs and into an open apartment on the right with the number 7 above it. After walking inside, I heard a scream behind me and then turned to see my sister crying sitting on the top step, her foot bleeding profusely. My dad came up the stairs and carried her inside, and then I went to my room to find 2 mattresses lined up on the wall. That was around when the dream ended. Again, it was so vivid that I never forgot it. I just wrote it off as a weird dream. Well, around 3 years later, my family and I moved into a new apartment complex, Tradewinds Quay. The day we moved in was the first time my siblings and I had seen the apartment. My parents had been there before and had some small furniture already there waiting on us. Upon getting out of the car, I instantly recognized the wooden staircase, but ignored it in my excitement. My sister and I ran up the stairs despite Dad's warnings, and as I made it to the top of the stairs and into the open doorway, I heard the exact same scream, turned exactly the same way, and found her sitting on the floor crying in the exact position from my dream. Her foot was bleeding because she caught it on a nail that was sticking out of the top step, which I somehow missed. When this happened, I had the most intense déjà vu that I have ever had in my life to date. I already knew that I was experiencing the dream I had had years before, but I decided to see if everything was the same as in the dream. I checked and saw that the apartment number was 7, and then went back inside into the room that would be mine and my brother's. My parents hadn't actually told us which room would be ours yet, so my parents were confused. I saw the mattresses lined up on the wall and was hit with another wave of déjà vu. My dad came in a short time after and asked how I knew which room to go to, and I told him I had seen the apartment before. I don't think he actually knew what I meant at the time, and he didn't respond. To date, I haven't had another vivid dream like this. I've had one dream since childhood that came true, and it was at 16. It was a tiny fragment of a moment where I saw my friend stand up as another boy got in his face. About a week later, this happened, and my friend got suspended for fighting the boy. This has led me to believe that children possess a sixth sense, and it dulls as they grow into adults because they aren't honing it. We actively use our ears to listen, our eyes to see, our hands to feel, our nostrils to smell, and our tongues to taste. We are not using this sixth sense for anything. I believe that as the human body develops, the senses grow stronger, pushing other senses that may exist, such as precognition, to the background, never to be used again. Hopefully you get around to reading this email. I'm thinking you will find it interesting, at least. Well, if you were thinking that, perhaps that was precognition on your part, because I do find it interesting, Jake, and I certainly enjoyed reading it here. He says, keep up the amazing work you've been doing, and thanks. Well, thank you for sharing your story. A couple of quick thoughts here. You know, for my own part, as I mentioned a couple of weeks ago when I brought up that subject, it's not unusual to me to think of something like limited precognition in terms of the evolutionary advantage it might afford us. If you have a quote-unquote sixth sense that is entirely natural, but it's a little understood phenomenon that at times may give you brief glimpses of future events, that may be helpful. This is certainly the kind of thing that would have served as an evolutionary benefit toward human survival in ancient times, and of course still might today. That doesn't really seem all that strange or impossible to me, and if anything, some of my own thinking about that came not from reading books on precognition or anything along those lines. No, it had been Stephen Hawking's A Brief History of Time. And when I went on the Astonishing Legends podcast with my pals Scott and Forrest, great couple of guys, they had me on the program to talk about human perception of time. And we touched on this, so definitely check out that episode. I think the episode was really about time slips, but they kind of had me come on to offer a sort of scientific perspective on that idea and about human perception of time in general. But in the chapter in Hawking's book on the thermodynamic arrow of time, the late Sir Stephen Hawking is laying out the idea that human perception of time has to agree essentially with the thermodynamic arrow of time, which is the same direction, quote-unquote, in which entropy increases. And in Hawking's mind, he said, this is why we remember past events, but we cannot remember the future, because that would disagree with that thermodynamic arrow of time. And it got me thinking, well, what if there were physical properties in this universe, however rare they are in occurrence, that might allow for so-called precognition, or in this case, what we might effectively call a memory of the future? Whatever it is that is happening in the human mind, it is the exact same process that leads to memory formation, but just occurring in reverse. Maybe, just maybe, remember, this is just speculation. I've given you a lot of it this week, and that's coming from a geek who likes to read a lot about science. I am no expert, but again, maybe there is a process as yet unknown or undiscovered, but which could account for these so-called memories of the future. And if we think of something like precognition in terms of how memory functions, it sort of demystifies it. It doesn't seem quite so strange to me. It may be uncommon, yes, but it may be a very natural occurrence, one that is as natural as memory itself and as natural as dreams. But maybe science just hasn't quite figured out how something like that could be accounted for. Maybe one day we will. Maybe with the help of artificial intelligence and machine learning. Who knows? All right, when we come back, we will be joined by the legendary folklorist Thomas E. Bullard, PhD, on the Micah Hanks program. Welcome back. It is the Micah Hanks Program. Glad as always to be your host as we explore the anomalous. And we've got some exploration to do this hour because I wanted to talk with our guest this week for quite a while. It's been a trend in recent months here on this show to speak with members of the scientific community who have weighed in on topics like UFOs, and that is certainly something that Thomas E. Bullard, PhD, has done. More on that and him in a moment, but first I do want to remind you, if you enjoy this program, there are ways that you can show support and get a little something to show for it. And the best way, of course, is to sign up for an X account. All you got to do is head over to MicahHanks.com/podcast. Right there in the upper right-hand corner of the page, you will see X subscriptions. And you can also head over to our legacy page, GralianReport.com/X. But by signing up, you get a weekly additional podcast as well as monthly specials like the Enigmas program. That's definitely something to look forward to. More than 50 episodes in the back catalog, which you get full access to. And of course, all of that, including the weekly free show here on your own custom RSS feed. And so, of course, we appreciate all you guys who have been subscribers of the show for a long time. And we welcome those who are new to the fold. So sign up today over there at MicahHanks.com/podcast. We look forward to seeing more of you. And of course, I got to remind you here in maybe just the next couple of weeks, if all goes according to plan, we will be dropping the new cryptozoology supplemental podcast once a month or so. That's right. Jeff and Smokey and I will be sitting down and exploring the subject of Sasquatch and other anomalous phenomena in the world of biology and zoology. And I haven't officially announced the name of that podcast yet, but I did go ahead and let subscribers know over the weekend. That's right. It's been the first official announcement that I've made anywhere. So that went out for subscribers first. And you guys in the coming days are going to be hearing all about it. And of course, there's going to be a brand new podcast I hope that you'll be able to enjoy really soon. Some of the friends of the program and also some members of the scientific community have actually been given a preview of this show. And I am excited to say we've gotten some really good feedback about this. And I know it's driving everybody nuts. I'm getting emails and tweets from a lot of you guys. When is this thing going to launch? How much longer are you going to keep us in suspense? Well, I think we're going to be wrapping the final sessions for the first few episodes that we're going to launch all together at the outset. And then there'll be monthly installments thereafter. And so we want to give you guys a bunch of stuff to get caught up on and enjoy. And of course, this is not going to be an edition just for subscribers. This one is going to be a monthly additional podcast for everyone to enjoy. And so we're really looking forward to that. But all of that said, what I am really looking forward to right now is to get into this conversation with our guest, Thomas Bullard. Now, he is a board member of the Center for UFO Studies and the Fund for UFO Research and author of UFO Abductions, The Measure of a Mystery, as well as The Sympathetic Ear, Investigators as Variables in UFO Abduction Reports. He attended the University of North Carolina as an undergraduate and Indiana University for graduate school, where he received his doctorate degree in folklore in 1982, writing his dissertation, you guessed it, on UFOs. And that, of course, brings us to his most recent work on the topic, which is The Myth and Mystery of UFOs, a book published by the University Press of Kansas in 2010, and one that had been for a long time on my reading list. And when I finally was able to obtain a copy, it is arguably, in my opinion, one of the top three best books on this subject that gives one of the most complete overviews on UFOs that I have ever seen in print. So I am really excited to have him here and to join us, the legendary folklorist and Fortean, Thomas E. Bullard, PhD. Thomas, welcome to the program. How are you?
Fine. How are you?
Doing really well in these unusual times. And
yes, that's good to hear.
As I've told everyone in recent weeks that I've had the opportunity to speak with, if there is one benefit to so many people being at home, it is that it is allowed for conversations like this. And I've certainly wanted to talk to you for a long time. And you and I both hail from the state of North Carolina, where I am right now, home of the famous Brown Mountain Lights. Have you ever been down to the Brown Mountain or the Linville Gorge area?
Yes, yes. I even had a roommate once who lived near there and had some wonderful stories to tell, probably quite fictitious, about parking with girls, of course, at the base of the mountain and seeing these big balls of light come rolling down the mountain, you know, several yards in diameter. And then around the bottom, there would be these little lights that would flicker around and make kind of hissing sounds like cats.
Uh-huh. Yeah, you hear a lot of very interesting stories. And again, that's an interesting place kind of for us to begin, because the Brown Mountain Lights are perhaps a real phenomena. There could be an Earthlight phenomena, but it's the layers of myth and folklore that have been kind of projected onto that over the years. In the 1930s and 40s, there were ghost lights. By the 1950s and the arrival of the flying saucers right after the Second World War, some began to interpret them as UFOs. So more broadly speaking, the UFO phenomenon tends to be one of those things that reflects the current attitudes and public perceptions at any given time, doesn't it?
Yes, very much. Because you can go back into the past where you have the Phantom Airships of 1897. To us, they've become UFOs. The UFO literature treats them as UFOs. But in their time, they were airships. And they were, you know, fairly primitive flying machine type things, kind of a hybrid balloon and with bird wings or something of the sort that would never have actually flown. But it's what people really expected to see. And that's pretty much how they described them.
Right. And of course, you know, Jerry Clark and a number of researchers yourself, again, I know that, and we'll talk more about this later, because for part of your doctoral research, as I understand it, you had been going to newspaper archives and looking at some of those reports from the 1890s. But before we get into some of that, your professional area is the study of folklore. I think a lot of people misunderstand what a folklorist does when they approach a topic like UFOs. So who better to ask than you, since we have you here? How exactly does a folklorist look at UFOs?
Folklorists usually try to stay away from deciding what the physical phenomenon is. And that may be an unfortunate thing. I know David Hufford has done a lot of studies of experiential phenomena. Most folklorists are really content to study how, you know, messages are communicated, essentially, and how people treat them. But that's probably not what most people are interested in who are interested in UFOs. We are interested in the way people think about these things. And what you do have is a kind of the way people would think has to do with their own time, with their own interests, with their own needs.
Mm-hmm.
And in that way, many of the UFO stories have taken over the role that fairies and omens and ghost lights and such sorts of things used to serve.
Right. You know, when people talk about Jacques Vallée, for instance, A Passport to Magonia, back in the 1960s, he is presenting this idea, which actually I think it frustrated a lot of people, Eddie, that there wasn't really any conclusion. Rather than being an idea, it was similar in that sense that he was looking at existing folkloric staples and noting the fact that there were similarities in the modern approach to studying UFOs. And that, to me, really kind of outlines a lot of this in the sense that you must recognize the continuity between British Isles fairy folklore, indigenous traditions from around the world about spirit folk and supernatural occurrences, and UFOs, because at the end of the day, it all comes down to the fact that human beings are the receptors of these, or the ones who are perceiving this phenomena. You wouldn't really have a UFO sighting if you didn't have a person seeing it, right?
Well, you have to have someone seeing something to create the story, to perpetuate the story. Although, you know, once something gets into the public mind, it usually goes on and on.
Mm-hmm.
It may go through variations, but it may not even be reinforced by the same phenomenon. It's often, you know, we'll find something new, like many people have used airplanes. They see lights in the sky, and that becomes a UFO. So that becomes a reinforcement of a narrative that people have honed over the years having to do with UFOs. And that UFO narrative in itself may have its template in something that's been in the folk mind for millennia.
Right. Yeah, you know, I think back about Alan Dundas, who wrote about the processes of identification and interpretation in folklore, really kind of groundbreaking work in that discipline. And I can't help but see UFOs as both a topic that must be approached as myth or folklore, but also explored as a subject of more tangible study. How does one find that balance? I know you attempt that, of course, in your fantastic work. How does one balance it between the study of the folklore and the tangible reality that might be behind some of these kinds of reports?
Well, once again, I think the folklore, the field, the academic field, has sort of neglected the experiential side, which is a necessary part if you want to understand anything else about it. I think it's unfortunate that they've done that. But it is a very hard thing to balance. I mean, obviously, people have a lot of beliefs. Beliefs are a perfectly legitimate field for study. But they also have these reinforcing experiences. And it's really, the balance is difficult to strike. There's just no question about that.
Yeah. You know, you mentioned David J. Hufford. I had the pleasure of interviewing him about sleep paralysis a few years ago,
yes.
Eddie. And you reference him a lot in your work. It's obvious that you and he are colleagues and that you, have a mutual appreciation for one another. You've written about David's, his warning, I think. In fact, he wrote in 1983 how scholarly traditions of disbelief are powerful influences in the way folklorists study their materials, which, kind of to your point, there is often sort of a dismissive attitude toward a physical reality and UFOs to be studied by a scholarly or from any scholarly perspective. It generally falls into sociology or folklore. And so, like you're saying, it seems that that aspect, that side of this topic seems to be neglected almost in the sciences and in academic studies.
Well, that's true. The UFOs have met negative receptions from the physical scientists, but also from many of the social sciences and humanities. I mean, there's many good reasons for that. I mean, most UFO reports do turn out to be some sort of mistaken identity, but there's also a part left over that is quite fascinating in its own right. And it's unfortunate that there's not more consideration for that. There's also the confusion between what people actually see and what they describe, what they talk about, because there's a strong tendency to reshape an experience into familiar terms. And those familiar terms involve the beliefs and the expectations that you have in the first place.
Right.
Like people in 1897 were looking at a light in the sky and they thought it was the headlight of an airship.
Yeah.
It wasn't, but that's just the way they thought.
Yeah, it certainly was. You know, this might be a good time to get into some of that, because I know that, going back to your early years, you had spent some of your time doing doctoral work, traveling to various newspaper archives and studying those airship reports, which I can only imagine was quite an undertaking in the pre-internet era. Eddie, where you're actually having to travel and sift through those kinds of reports. Nowadays, if you've got a newspapers.com account, it's much easier to find reports. So you were doing it back in the day when it required a lot of work, a lot of travel, a lot of expense, and you were analyzing this phenomena in those early instances, these what some call precursors to the modern UFO narrative. But obviously, there are some similarities. Let's talk a little about your work in that area.
Okay. Yeah, I did do a lot of traveling around. I probably saw some over 3,000 1896-97 newspapers. And I've also started up again when the computerized opportunities have arisen.
I bet.
And they're now there's quite a lot on the internet that you can get on these things now. And, I have hundreds and hundreds of pages of reports, and I'm actually trying to write a book on that.
Oh, wow. Yeah, that's something to look forward to. I absolutely love it. It's almost, I compare it to comfort food, being able to look at old newspapers. I'm sure you know what I mean. There's a certain comfort that comes from that. And what's also really interesting, though, is that I think that there are certain phenomena which have generally been dismissed as having been modern creations, which Now that there is a greater ease of access to newspaper archives online, some are made available for free through the Library of Congress. I often tell people, please make use of their Chronicling America newspaper archives.
Yes.
Those are freely available. I also pay to access newspapers.com for the same purpose. But I think what we're finding with the ease of access to earlier newspapers and keyword searches, where now these things can be indexed as a...
Yes. That makes it much easier to find or fan of airship or UFO type reports outside of 1896-97. I mean, it would take you forever if you were just going, you know, year by year.
Yes, as you had
like
done.
Like Fort did.
Yeah, and as like Fort did, yes. But, you know, again, that has really opened up the research tools that are available to researchers. So what kinds of things has the digital and the digitization of newspaper archives, what has that shown you, or does it shift your approach in the way that you interpret earlier, let's call them pre-ufology reports of aerial phenomena?
I don't know that it's changed it much. I know some people have done a great deal of work with these computerized newspapers and keyword searching, and have found all kinds of things going on in the 19th century and early 20th century that have some relationship to UFOs or the kind of things we have come to consider anomalies. And you find all kinds of them in the past, like monsters of hairy monsters or wild men or whatever you want to call them.
Mm-hmm.
This has gone on, and then there's all kinds of lights in the sky, not just airships or unusual objects seen in the sky. There's a lot of it out there. It's just hard to put together. What do you do with all of that stuff?
Yes, exactly. Yeah. Although I guess one big takeaway is that now that we have easier access to information in online mediums and in databases and in searchable form like that, it definitely shows us it gives us great opportunities to collect data. Again, like you said, what do we do with it? I was talking with a friend recently who's having to completely outside of this area of research. She's compiling a report basically on climate science information and what the worth of that data is once it's been collected and how you communicate to people the importance of it. This seems to be an issue that I've seen in UFO research for years, Eddie, where we're collecting a lot of data about these incidents and the continuity that might exist between reports over the decades. But there's got to be a point at which you say, okay, now that we've got all this data, what do you do with it?
It's a real tough question for any field, really. It's kind of fun to collect the stuff, but then having to do some kind of analysis, that's work.
Yeah, right. But maybe that's where science comes into it as well. Let's go back a little here. I know that prior to your entry into the area professionally as a folklorist and approaching ufology in that context, you had been very interested. You'd followed this throughout your life. Going all the way back to 1957, we had the sightings that were occurring around Loveland, Texas at that time. And I know that you were pretty involved in that. In fact, you actually mentioned those reports specifically in your book. Let's talk about that in your own research into those as they were occurring.
Well, I was in the third grade at the time.
Yeah.
And, just sat down spread out on the floor to read about the latest on Sputnik and saw this thing about these egg-shaped or elongated objects landing on highways and stopping cars. It was certainly a fascinating consideration, especially when I heard that these might be flying saucers, and flying saucers might be from Mars or outer space somewhere. So it was the kind of thing that a kid would really take an interest in. I didn't actually do any formal research on it, but it became the kind of thing I wanted to follow anytime I could find something to read about it, which there wasn't all that much in those days.
Sure. Yeah, but I guess there are some limitations for a researcher when your funding is basically a weekly allowance and you have to be in by 8 p.m. every night, right?
Exactly.
Yeah. I was like that, though. When I was in third grade, I wrote my first report on UFOs, and my teacher gave me a B because she said that this was supposed to be a science report, and she said it was well written, but she didn't endorse the topic I had picked. And yeah, and she stood me up in front of the class and kind of said, listen, there's just no hard evidence. But it was interesting for me because that was, even at that age, like yourself, I was kind of introduced to some of the tropes of research in this field, that there's going to be essentially kind of a gatekeeping aspect that you will encounter among many academics who will say, you know, this is great to talk about in the context of myth and folklore, but, you know, don't dare approach this as though you're going to try and apply a science to it. In third grade, I knew no better. I see the books, I read what people say that they've seen, and I presume there must be something going on. And I think that Thomas E. Bullard, PhD, thinks so too, but he also brings that very important perspective of a folklorist to this conversation. And I want to get a little deeper into this discussion about UFOs with him when we return right here on the Micah Hanks program. Welcome back. Continuing our conversation with Thomas E. Bullard, PhD. He's the author of The Myth and Mystery of UFOs and one of the few really serious academic researchers who has spent decades pursuing this phenomenon and also taking a not only folklorist's perspective on it, but also incorporating elements of sociology and a number of other disciplines, too. And, of course, also looking at the possibility that, hey, maybe in some instances we really have a tangible phenomenon behind this as well. But getting back into this conversation with you, certainly people see things. The question is, beyond the levels of human perception, how do we quantify what they're seeing?
Well, that's always been a problem. We know that there are thousands and thousands of reports that are made every year. MUFON and National UFO Reporting Center collect, you know, 8, 9, 10,000 reports a year. That's a huge number of reports, and you know there must be a far more sightings than there are these reports. But we also know that most of them are mistaken identities. What's left is a very small number of cases that are, you know, really interesting. And many of those are going to turn out to be, you know, gray area type cases, things that you just can't really make much out of. But then there is this final residue of cases that are just truly fascinating that investigators have not been able to explain. And that means skeptical investigators like Condon or Blue Book. And just to know that those things are there, that makes for a very interesting interesting sense that there is a little, there's another dimension of our world that we really know about.
Right.
Or really acknowledge.
Yes, and something that, you know, again, without making any kind of assertions about its origins or what it may constitute, there, of course, seems to be the implication. It is implied, based on certain witness accounts, that there may be intelligence behind some of the phenomena that has been observed. But again, it is a bit of a leap to say, therefore extraterrestrial, therefore ultra-terrestrial, metaterrestrial, interdimensional, you know, whatever your favorite pet theory may be. But now on that point, having looked at the history of this phenomena as you have, and of course this is really a theme in The Myth and Mystery of UFOs, you touch on the fact that Charles Fort really maybe was one of the first who was looking at these things outside of being anomalous phenomena or supernatural phenomena, ghost lights, prodigies or portents, and he is saying, listen, maybe We're looking at a super Zeppelin, you know, something has dropped anchor. He seems to be sort of ascribing the notion that these may have some, you know, some sort of a source outside of Earth. Would you say he was really the first and therefore one who really shaped attitudes that would emerge only in the decades to follow about the broader UFO phenomena?
Well, he certainly thought more in the modern terms, or what would become the modern terms of ufology, than anyone before. And though the idea that there were, you know, beings on other planets goes back a long way and had a long course of literature, and even it was even part of astronomy for astronomers to believe that there were other worlds just like ours, and just took that as for granted, mm-hmm. called the plurality of worlds.
Yes.
And they, in a few cases, did conceive of some kind of travel between worlds. But it was really Ford who, and the science fiction writers, of course, who did a lot of shaping of the way we think now.
Yeah. That's interesting to me, too, because it's very difficult for anyone, really, to look at the UFO phenomena in a very objective way. And by that, I mean outside of the influences, you know, cosmic pluralism, as written about by the philosophers for centuries prior to Charles Fort, arguing that there might be, you know, some sort of a intelligence from elsewhere. You know, Jules Verne, H.G. Wells, you know, all of the great science fiction writers that are driving home these science fiction narratives, those things, I mean, there's no way to escape their influence on our interpretation of what may be reality at times.
Right.
Yeah. Now, I also should ask you, Eddie, in the 1980s, of course, the alien idea, the extraterrestrial thing, takes on a whole new dimension as abduction reports begin to appear. You have written some really fantastic papers over the years that address that subject, and I want to talk with you a little about that. UFO abductions, the measure of a mystery. You analyzed 300 reports involving alleged UFO kidnappings. You note there's some similarities yet again to folklore. Let's get a little into that and how those two phenomena, folklore that has existed for centuries and the modern abduction mythos, how those two mirror one another.
Yeah. Well, there were undeniable similarities. The fairy kidnap theme is very similar to the kind of thing that people report in abductions, like you're taken off, in a sense, to another world. In the case of the fairies, it's kind of adjacent to our own, or somehow interlinked with our own. With the abduction, of course, you're taken into a spaceship, but you're also subjected to some kinds of physical examination, which is more a part of shamanic initiations than fairy lore, but it's still part of a number of folkloric themes that intertwine in the actual beliefs of real people. So you get a great deal of comparable points, but the thing is, the comparable points say that we maybe think about alien abductions in the same way as we once thought of fairies and shamanic initiations. It doesn't necessarily mean that the abduction doesn't happen. It just means that the way we understand it, the way we think about it, is going to be based on this familiar model.
Right. You know, on the note of that model, you wrote in your paper, actually a couple of decades ago now, what matters here is not the ultimate nature of the reports, but their status as narratives, their form, content, and relationship to comparable accounts of supernatural encounter. That abduction narrative, you know, the supernatural kidnapping, that is something that you find throughout a diverse number of mythologies, including some modern ones. You know, there are the Sasquatch kidnappings, which those aren't necessarily modern, but to equate a modern phenomena that nonetheless has that, you know, that association made to it. We have people who claim that they are kidnapped by government agencies and taken to underground bunkers, you know, and turned into Manchurian candidates. It, again,
yes.
that kidnapping element is something that is pervasive in different forms of folklore and belief systems.
Yeah, you have to realize that there is a sort of a universal background to many of our beliefs. Well, David Hufford pointed out that the supernatural kidnap, or the old hag, or the attack by some kind of supernatural being that comes in the night and oppresses you, that has a physiological basis as well as a cultural basis, a cultural basis of understanding. Mm-hmm. And that can be, the same can be said for so many of the ideas that we have. Like the supernatural kidnap is truly universal, just as the supernatural attack. It's in Chinese, it's in Japanese, it's in ancient Egyptian literature. You'll find it anywhere and everywhere, and it just seems to suggest that there are certain universals of human thought, something maybe left over from our evolutionary course back from the time when we were being attacked by saber-toothed tigers or something of that sort.
Right. Well, you know, Jung talked about, of course, the collective unconscious and archetypes, and I recall hearing the evolutionary biologist Brett Weinstein recently saying that archetypes are essentially the sort of vestiges of experiences that our ancestors had that, you know, again, served an evolutionary benefit. We remember something that was traumatic or meaningful, and sometimes aspects of that memory, I don't literally advocate some sort of transmission of memory from, you know, one's grandparents or something, although to an extent, many scientists argue that the idea of a cultural memory or certain ways that knowledge seems to be transmitted through the ages in cultures, and therefore those things remain. Perhaps it is transmitted through myth. Perhaps it is transmitted in some even more esoteric way that science has yet to fully understand. But what seems to remain is, again, that sort of archetype, that sort of framework, which seems to present a peculiar continuity between myths and folklore from around the world. And yes, these sorts of quote-unquote supernatural encounters.
Yeah, I think you'd have to look for some kind of basic background of the way we think, if we want to understand the stories we tell. It may be the stories themselves that are preserving all this, but somewhere there's probably a background of experience or something that has shaped the way we think, the way our particular cultures have adapted to realities of the world they live in, that's caused these things to be shaped into the basis for our stories.
Yeah. You know, something that really fascinates me about your writing on this subject, Eddie, is the idea of theophany, especially as it appears in Abduction Reports, the meeting of a divine being, which to me is in a lot of ways where some of these reports break from being something we would perceive as being a physical, tangible experience. I think about Betty Andreessen and how strange and, again, religious her own experience became there toward the end. But what do you make of the study of abduction and the prevalence of that theophany in this sort of framework that you lay out for, the common themes that occur and that recur, in fact, throughout these abduction cases?
Yeah. I would say that probably this kind of theme does reflect some of the beliefs of the individual who has them. Now, Betty Andreessen was a very religious person. I think she might anticipate or interpret an event more in that way and give it more emphasis than would someone who did not have a strong religious background. But there may be it may be a matter of people having some kind of very extreme experience, like being in a natural disaster or something of that sort, might tend to see some kind of or make some kind of religious connection to that they survived it, and there must have been some kind of it becomes meaningful to them, because if it has some kind of religious implication.
Right. Which may not preclude the idea that in some instances there is a physical reality behind it, or that there is something, an actual physical component, an instigator, an agent. But yet again, we have our own sort of mythic values system that gets projected onto those experiences, either maybe to help us, and again, maybe you can help fill in the blank here, but I'll get us rolling here by saying either to account for, to conform to our expectations, maybe to help us cope even with a circumstance like that. If it has a religious value, does that make it easier to cope with, perhaps?
Yes, I would think that would be a very likely influence. We can only understand the new, the novel, the inexplicable, by connecting it to something we already know. The result may be that we do a lot of damage to the actual experience, the actual memories, but what we get in return is something we can understand, something we can deal with. If it's bad, we can, you know, maybe fight against it or resist it. If it's good, then we can embrace it and make it useful as to change our lives or improve them, or at least to feel good about what happened rather than bad.
Yeah. Again, I could see it as being a sort of necessary coping mechanism that when humans are confronted with something that they don't understand, we project certain aspects of our own belief systems onto it to make it a little bit more digestible or something that's more relatable. You know, on the topic of relatability, Eddie, at one point in The Myth and Mystery of UFOs, you note how Carl Sagan had published a skeptical article on alien abduction claims. And afterward, he had, of course, famously said he received several letters from alleged experiencers who claimed to have met not just aliens, but ghosts. Some even said they met Jesus Christ. But
right.
One of the more rational-sounding letters, of course, that he received came from a grandmother who, in a much less, or seemingly less, sensational manner, said she'd had all kinds of alien abductions or similar experiences throughout her life. You noted in your book, they would seem problematic enough to engage scientific curiosity, yet Sagan passed them by without any curiosity at all. And this is sort of one of the issues I take with the modern uber-skeptical attitude. We should always be skeptical. But when there is something that should kind of spark scientific curiosity and ends up being completely ignored instead, that seems to be almost not just problematic, but entirely counterintuitive. You know, what do you feel are the reasons for that sort of ignoring problems rather than even exploring them?
Well, that's one of the things that David Hufford discussed in his Traditions of Disbelief. You have these established norms, these ideas that of what we think is true and what isn't. And it's very hard, even for very intelligent scientific people, to break with those norms. There's also the notion that you have to have a scientific revolution every now and then to break through the old paradigms and create a new one. And it doesn't happen very gradually. It does tend to be an actual revolutionary event when you get a major change in your worldview. I think it's just a natural self-protective action, in a sense. You don't want to throw out a good system of understanding that you already have. So you're going to fight for that. You're going to resist anything that challenges it. But at the same time, you're also closing your mind to any new, anything novel, anything that might really change it, unless, you know, under unusual circumstances, somebody will come along with a new idea that forces change. But there's going to be a tooth and nail resistance to that, kind of an ego thing, I would guess it is.
Yeah, I think that there is an aspect of it that involves ego, which is interesting too, especially with regard to Carl Sagan, because there is what is known as the Sagan effect. My colleague Dr. One Pagan has written about this quite a bit, the idea that from time to time, sometimes the resistance to a scientist who proposes novel ideas or who maybe just takes on a generally favorable appearance in the public mind, they can tend to be dismissed. And the question is not so much whether they are just a celebrity science. Sometimes it may have to do with, you know, professional jealousy. There are a lot of different factors that lead to this so-called Sagan effect, which Carl, of course, since the name would entail, he was very much a recipient of, you know, critics from his profession that antagonized him both for being a public communicator, but perhaps also out of jealousy that they weren't the one that was on camera appearing on Cosmos and shows like that. And so it's interesting, right? Because, yeah, Sagan probably understood that antagonism better than most, and yet many saw him as being the, you know, antagonist in chief about UFOs and the supernatural. I mean, the arch skeptic, which actually he seemed at times to be at least open to certain possibilities. I mean, to be a skeptic, he wrote quite a bit about UFOs, you know?
Yes, yeah. Well, yeah. I think it's always true that you've got these, you know, all through science, you've got this jealousy effect. But the truth is that in most cases, new ideas are going to turn out to be wrong. There's not going to be that many that turn out to be revolutionary, that are really going to, you know, change the course of things. So, you know, if you're hedging your bets, you'd probably want to go with the established than you would with the with some new and radical idea that will probably turn out to be refuted and dismissed as untrue.
Yeah, well, that makes sense, and I can't fault, you know, scientists, skeptics for doing that. I think a lot of people in the so-called UFO community, they do. They take a personal offense at a skeptic trying to err on the side of caution. I understand completely what they're trying to do. And for doing that, perhaps I often am kind of labeled more skeptically inclined myself. I think some have also seen you as a skeptic. You have been referred to, Eddie, as being again, one of the sociocultural type researchers into UFOs. Again, in your writing, what I see is that you say we must understand the social side, the mythological, the folkloric, but that does not preclude the possibility that there are phenomena behind this topic. I mean, do you ever feel that there's a sort of stratification and that some maybe see you as too skeptical because you're looking at the folklore angle?
Well, there are some people who take any kind of skepticism as a, you know, heresy, disloyalty. But if you don't, then you're really not going to find the thing you're really looking for, which is the truth. You know, where are the really good cases? Do they really mean that there is something from outside or something that we don't know, you know, whatever the actual cause of the phenomenon might be? I do think there is ample evidence that there is something unusual out there. What it is, I don't know. And I don't feel the need to go somewhere I don't know where know anything about and try to make something out of that. But I understand that there's a lot of personal investment that people make in UFOs being real. They want them to be spaceships. They don't care really about you know, the rationality of the conclusion. Like the Phoenix lights, you can very clearly explain those as being a group of airplanes flying across the state of Arizona that a lot of people saw, and they turned into UFOs in the ways people thought about them. And they're still claimed to be, you know, one of the, you know, the greatest mass sighting in all history. But a lot of people saw it, but what they saw were airplanes,
yeah,
military airplanes. And then, well, later on that night, some flares dropped from military airplanes. The case is very strong that that's the solution. But people don't want to hear that if they believe in UFOs. It's unfortunate. Because if you don't have some skepticism, you become an easy target for the people who don't want to believe. They can say, "Well, you know, look at this." They'll accept anything as a UFO.
Yeah.
It shouldn't be that way.
Right. And of course, we could have that discussion about the Phoenix Lights. I know I've got listeners out there who write in, I was there, I saw them. And of course, we have to acknowledge that there were also some aircraft that were known to be in the air that night, too. We're going to wrap up our conversation with Thomas E. Bullard when we come back, and I want to talk a little about UFO television with him when we return right here on the Micah Hanks Program. Rounding out another week in pursuit of the enigmatic and anomalous with our guest, Thomas E. Bullard, Ph.D. Quite a conversation this has been. I do, of course, always want to remind you guys, we will have the full list of show notes linked over there at MicahHanks.com/podcast, where we post the programs each week with links to where you can find The Myth and Mystery of UFOs, highly recommended reading for any serious student of ufology. Now, one area I definitely do not advocate that people put all of their trust and faith in when it comes to information that one can glean about UFOs is what we see on television. And also the way that just popular media in general has been the home for most discussion of these topics for a number of decades. That, I don't think, has helped encourage scientists and you know, academics to want to get involved in the serious study of these sorts of things. I think that maybe at times it's fair to say that there has been unfair stigmatization, I guess, as a result of the mediums in which these subjects have kind of flourished. Whereas in truth, there very well may be something to it. And here again, this comes back to the whole skeptical perspective. I don't fault skeptics for being cautious about becoming involved when they see so little science involvement. But at some point, you know, the tides maybe have to shift. Now, I've got to ask you about this also. With some of the current technological advances, and specifically the Raytheon company's AtFLIR targeting pod that the Navy's been using, it has resulted in three pieces of footage that are now publicly available. There may be others, but they seem to give us some really unique perspectives in terms of instrumental data about unusual aerial phenomena. We won't talk about the technical side of it right now. We're not probably specialists in that field, but I'm interested in your perspective on, are we now looking at an era perhaps where science and technology maybe will help us, you know, at least pin down that there could be a tangible phenomena, and maybe the case for study of it will be strengthened?
I would say undoubtedly so. The information we've gotten from the Nimitz case, 2004, the USS Theodore Roosevelt sightings in 2014-15, and this footage we've seen is certainly among the most impressive that we've ever seen. And, well, photographic evidence is pretty difficult anyway. There are lots of ways of making mistakes or even of faking it, you know. So, you know, is it live or is it Photoshop?
Yeah.
So that's always been highly questionable, but, you know, here we have it from an authoritative source. I think we can assume the Navy isn't faking it.
Pretty evident, huh?
Yeah. So, I think we've got something really, really powerful here to show that there is a physical phenomenon. What it is, that, again, becomes a problem. But it hardly seems likely that if we're testing some kind of super drones or some new kind of aircraft propulsion, why, if we had it in 2004, are we still making jet planes now? It just doesn't make much sense.
That's a really good point. But another one, too, that I often see people neglect is, well, that's probably just a new drone. Oh, that's just, you know, our own technology. And for whatever reason, you know, the pilots involved in that intercept, they weren't informed. You know, this may have been some sort of a, you know, some sort of a test. They were gauging their reaction. But I say to that, how can we account, going back at very least to the end of the Second World War, but if we look at the so-called pre-ufological reports, perhaps even earlier, you know, how do we account for similar descriptions of aerial objects that go back that far in time? Again, I think it really is incumbent upon us to understand this phenomenon in its totality, and therefore understanding the history is helpful too. So, you know, going in the opposite direction, like you're saying, why aren't we using more of that technology in our current leading edge aircraft? Well, I would say who had that technology decades ago when these things were being seen back then?
Yeah, exactly. I couldn't agree more. It's wonderful that some of this is actually coming out, because it's sort of like it almost leaked around the edges with this new program that some senators got together to study UFOs. And we got a lot of military reports in the late 1940s and early 1950s, but then they kind of clamped down on it. We didn't get very much, but when you start seeing the Tic Tac thing, it looks a bit different from what they were seeing in the 1950s, but it's essentially the same kind of thing. It's just kind of smooth, has high performance, high speed, runs circles around our jets. That's the same thing that we were getting back then. So, yeah, it is something that you'd have a very hard time explaining.
Yeah. Eddie, I have to also point out that, again, going back to 1957, the descriptions of the objects in the level and sightings that you were looking at when you were in third grade, long, tubular, or egg-shaped. Now, some of them were larger than the so-called Tic Tac, but, I mean, their general shape and dynamics were very similar to what appears in the Navy videos.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah, you get a lot of that, the flying saucer-type objects that would buzz military aircraft, fly circles around them like they were almost showing off, and then flying away. That's very much like what these Tic Tacs were doing.
It's fascinating to me to see that there is a certain degree of historical continuity, which, again, that doesn't remove the case for skepticism, but it certainly makes overt skepticism and dismissal a little more difficult. As far as concluding thoughts here, how does science proceed with the study of these sorts of phenomena, especially in an era where we may be looking at finally having instrumental data and innovative systems that are showing that perhaps there is more than mere myth to a subject like, for instance, UFOs?
Well, I think once you have some really solid data that can stand up to any kind of criticism, then there would science, even the most resistant scientists, would have a very hard time resisting that. I'm just afraid that human nature being what it is, there's going to be all kinds of ways to, you know, circumvent good evidence to preserve the status quo. One thing I noticed lately that, the Navy was talking about these films of the objects, and then a little bit later there was a report from the Navy of some small suitcase size objects flying around Navy operations areas.
Mm-hmm.
These things were very low performance, low speed. They were pretty obviously drones of some sort, probably being used for espionage purposes. So definitely a matter of interest to the Navy or to the government as a whole. But something that could also be used to discredit the better images, the better UFO reports that the Navy's been getting.
Interesting point. Yeah.
Yeah. So I just wonder if, that's the kind of route they'll take, if there's going to be some kind of resistance that is, well, okay, here we have cases of drones. These are definitely drones. And so they must all be drones. But of course, those things on film outrunning the jets are not drones in any normal sense, unless there's something very new and highly advanced. And that would probably something we probably didn't have in 2004 when they had similar objects in sight.
Yeah. Yeah. It would seem to be the case. You know, again, if this is new technology, it's interesting how often it has appeared over the decades. Dr. Bullard, I want to thank you for taking time today. This has really kind of been one of those bucket list conversations. I'm really excited to hear that you've got another book forthcoming, and maybe when that comes out, we can have this conversation again at some point, because I'm eager to see where your research is going to go.
Yeah, well, it's been my pleasure, and I've admired reading your material as well, to see that you're a real scientific-minded person.
Well, I try to
be. You run across very often in this field, but always glad to find it.
Well, thank you so much. And again, a compliment like that coming from you certainly is well appreciated. And I want to thank you again for being my guest this week here on the Micah Hanks program. We will have additional resources in the show notes and, of course, where you can find his book right there at MicahHanks.com. But that will wrap it up for this week, my friends. As always, this show is produced in Asheville, North Carolina. Our executive producers back at Master Control are Race Hobbs and Warren Brager. News tips are provided by Mark Brady, Janet Fitzgerald, and Adam Olson. Music featured on this show is produced by Caleb Hanks, and other show content for this program is produced every week by the wonderful Lauren Ellis. Special thanks goes out to Chris Hayes, Tyler Pittman, Robin Hobbs, Tiffany Mack, Jason Pentrail, James Waldo, and Matthew Oakley. I am Micah Hanks, and on behalf of all of us here in the bunker, thanks for listening, and as always, stay strange and safe out there.